Good evening and welcome to Health Matters, the mental health edition. I'm Dr. Shelley Visconti, licensed psychologist, counselor, and marriage and family therapist. And I'll be your host for our discussion this evening on mental illness and the criminal justice system. I'm joined by three fabulous guests. We have in the studio attorney Elton Ritchie and two forensic psychiatry fellows from LSU Health Shreveport, Drs. Vinay Kothpalli and Erica Parker. Welcome, everybody.
Hello.
Hi. Good evening.
So, Elton, I'm going to start with you. Talk to us a little bit about what you do. You're a criminal defense attorney. So, tell us a little bit about your practice and what a criminal defense attorney does.
Sure. I have been in practice here for about 25 years doing criminal defense. I actually began my career as a police officer in Shreveport way back in 77, I think. And was a police officer for about 10 years, left, went to law school, practiced in Savannah, Georgia for a year, and have come back to Shreveport in 1992 and began a practice then involving primarily criminal defense, some personal injury work. I also am a member of the faculty of the National Criminal Defense College in Macon, Georgia, where I spend time training young lawyers on how to try criminal cases.
Thank you, Elton. Drs. Kothpalli and Dr. Parker, would y'all talk a little bit about what y'all do as psychiatry fellows?
Sure. So forensic psychiatry involves the area where the legal system, the courtroom, might require the opinion of a psychiatrist, an expert opinion about how somebody's current mental status or mental status at the time that an act in question occurred, or how somebody's history of mental illness or diagnosis with a mental illness might impact their situation in a legal sense. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes the court might ask for an opinion when they have concerns about that matter.
Okay. So forensic psychiatrists practice in the area that where kind of the legal system and psychiatry kind of intersect.
That's correct. Okay. It could be in a criminal capacity. Mm-hmm. It could be involving civil matters, a variety of matters where an opinion might be, helpful.
Okay. So I want to invite our listeners to join in our conversation with any questions and comments. You can call in at 1-800-552-8502. And before we start, I wanted to just talk a little bit about some interesting statistics that we came across. One is from the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. And a fact sheet that they published said that mental illness, and this fact sheet was on mental illness in the criminal justice system. The statistics are a little old. It's from 2000, but unfortunately that's some of the best statistics we have right now. But there were a little over 1 million mentally ill people involved in the criminal justice system at that time. And then also in a 2006 report from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, in state prisons, approximately 73% of women and 55% of men had at least one mental health problem. And it's not just the state prisons. It's also the federal prisons, the local jails. They also, in that survey, they also found that a vast percentage of the inmates had some sort of mental health problem. So according to these statistics, the majority of inmates that are currently housed in correctional facilities have some sort of mental health diagnosis or problem. So this is a huge area where this intersects the criminal justice system and psychology and psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk a little bit about that. What are y'all's thoughts about those statistics, the high numbers that we have of people in the criminal justice system with mental health problems?
Doesn't surprise me at all. I would say that probably 50% of the cases that I deal with as a criminal defense lawyer across the board, clients have some sort of mental health issue that we have to deal with that usually is kind of the source of the problem that occurs that brings them into contact with the criminal justice system and, of course, brings them into my office. And a lot of times what I'm trying to do, even with minor offenses, is trying to sort out what the root cause of the problem is. I don't want repeat clients. I want to get people through the system. I hope to bounce them off of it in such a way that they never come back to the system. So I'm often looking to mental health professionals, and I think you and I have done this on more than one occasion, where we have typically a young person with some mental health issue that is going to present long-term problems for them if we don't find a way to deal with that and to create a kind of a safety net around them so that they can easily conform their behavior to the law and become productive citizens. I see it all the time. Very common for me.
But what about you, doctors? What are y'all's thoughts about the number of people with mental health problems in the criminal justice system?
I think that when you consider substance abuse, that number has probably grown considerably because a lot of people are penalized for, substance abuse, or rather, being caught with substances that are illegal, and that when you consider that along with other mental illness or what falls under the purview of mental illness, and you consider that mental illness is, those that suffer from behavioral illness or, aka mental illness, often need a lot of community supports to, remain healthy in a sense, to be compliant with treatment, to be compliant with medication. And when those supports don't exist or are lacking or are not accessible, it is easy for people to perhaps relapse into substance abuse or become non-compliant with their medications and become, mentally unstable, that kind of thing. And then that could impact how they interact with the legal system, with the being arrested or something like that, or doing something that might get them in trouble and they enter into that system, as Mr. Ritchie was talking about.
Yeah, and I agree. Although these statistics seem high and a little shocking, they're not terribly shocking to me. In fact, I think that probably these statistics are a little low, that there are more people in the criminal justice system that have mental health problems. As you said, if you also include those substance abuse issues, there are a lot of folks that are in the criminal justice system with mental health problems. And the National Association for the Mentally Ill, in their fact sheet, said that America's jails and prisons have become substitute mental institutions. What are y'all's thoughts about that?
I think that's a fairly accurate statement. We, in the 50s and 60s experience, and I think my colleagues here can talk more about it, the deinstitutionalization of mental health treatment. And that had a huge, tremendous impact on the increase of the jail population over the past about 50 years or so, right? And where we used to take people and find ways to confine them in a fairly humane situation, or what we thought was a fairly humane situation, and provide them treatment for their mental health problems, we kind of decided we weren't going to take that approach anymore. And I'm not sure what the real motivations behind that were. I suppose some were economic, some were political, some were, I think, humanitarian. The idea that somehow these people are better treated in the community. But I think the reality of what we've experienced is, at least from my perspective, is it's not more humane. It actually we end up treating them quite inhumanely, because we expect people who are not capable of conforming their behavior to society's, some of their basic norms, to do so. And then when they can't, we have to do something with them. So since we don't put them in a institutional setting, where they can be treated and can have some sort of productive lifestyle, then we end up putting them in jail and incarcerating them and effectively punishing people.
Sure. And I think it goes along well with what Dr. Kathapalli was saying about having good community support systems in place. I think the concept of deinstitutionalization was to have people be in the community. They could follow up with their doctors, follow up with appointments, stay on their medications. But one of the biggest problems is that is following up with your doctor, is staying compliant with your medications. And so, again, I think it goes back to having strong community supports, that if you aren't going to have the structure of an institution, then you have to have a structure in the community. And I think that's where people fall through the cracks.
Yeah, and that's what we struggle to try to create for a lot of the patients that I work with, is that structure in the community, those supports and those kind of safety nets to assist them. It's really difficult. Mm-hmm. There seemed to be a lot of controversy regarding legal insanity. Would y'all mind discussing that for a minute?
Sure. So,
Mr. Ritchie?
I didn't catch the question.
The discussion about the topic of legal insanity.
Yes. Sure, sure. Gosh, there's a lot of lot that can be said about insanity and the defense of not guilty by reason of insanity. And really, to kind of understand it, you kind of have to have some understanding of the history of that defense. It's an old defense. It goes back to you help me with the pronunciation here. You can find it mentioned in the Code of Hammurabi.
Right. I think Dr. Visconti was asking specifically first about the definition of legal insanity.
Well, again, you got to work with the history of it, because the definition shifts over time.
Right.
You go back into English common law, which is kind of where the United States draws its history. And you first see in the 1500s jurors acquitting defendants who claimed that they were insane or suffering from lunacy because they acted with the mind of a wild beast. And so it was kind of the wild beast mind defense. And that was kind of how it was articulated at the time. And then even from the 1500s, jurors were allowed to find defendants not guilty by insanity. And then, of course, they would promptly be committed. And then what happens is you move into the 1800s in England, and you have the development at common law of what's called the McNaughton rule, which articulates even the modern standard for insanity in Louisiana and across most of the United States. And the way the court said it at that time, McNaughton claimed the insanity defense. He was on trial for murdering a gentleman named Edwin Drummond, who was the secretary for then British Prime Minister Robert Peel. And he mistook Drummond for Peel and was on trial. And the ruling in the case, this goes back to 1843, this is how the court articulated the defense of insanity. If you could find the person not guilty by reason of insanity, if at the time of committing the act, the party accused was laboring under such a defect of reason from disease of the mind as not to know the nature and quality of the act he was doing, or not to know that what he was doing was wrong. Now, that's the core of the McNaughton rule. And you jump forward now, you look at Louisiana and most of the United States, which has adopted the McNaughton rule. And in Louisiana, that's codified at the Louisiana Revised Statute, Title 14, Section 14. And the way it's articulated is this: if the circumstances indicate that because of a mental disease or mental defect, the offender was incapable of distinguishing between right and wrong with reference to the conduct in question, that being the crime that was committed, then the offender shall be exempt from criminal responsibilities. So that's, you know, we really haven't advanced much in terms of this scope of the insanity defense since 1843. And in fact, efforts in the past to expand that defense have tended to be pushed back. And
why is that? Why have those efforts been pushed back?
Well, it's kind of you have to understand that insanity is not a, it's not a mental health definition. It's not a medical definition. Is that right, doctor?
Right.
It's a legal concept, and it has to do with the question of when are we going to say that someone who has committed an act which is a crime is not going to be held criminally responsible. Not that we're not going to hold them responsible or do something with them, but when are we going to not hold them criminally responsible? So it's really a question of moral culpability kind of at its core. So you, because crimes tend to be consist of two parts, what we call the actus reus or the, mm-hmm. the criminal act, and then the mens rea or the evil intent, as it were. Whereas a person who is insane is thought not to have the ability to form the mental intent aspect of the crime. So we don't hold them responsible as we would for someone who commits a crime with an evil mind. So over time, what tends to happen is with the insanity defense, it's invoked very rarely, less than 1% of the time, I think, and probably and much less often is it even successful.
And I think that's a common misconception that people think that it's used more frequently than it is.
Correct.
Yeah.
That is a very common misconception. And it's also a common misconception that it's successful. Most often it is simply not successful. Yeah. And I can give you some insight into that. But what happens is, for example, the McNaughton rule kind of developed to the point where in addition to this concept, an idea that someone couldn't understand the difference between right and wrong with regard to their conduct, it might also be you might also provide that they were insane if they weren't able to control their behavior because of some mental disease or defect, what was called the irresistible impulse situation. But what happens is usually it involves some sort of high-profile case. And most recently, in 1984, you remember who was shot at that time?
That was Reagan.
Ronald Reagan, that's right. And John Hinckley was tried and asserted an insanity defense successfully. And as a result, there was a lot of pushback against the insanity defense. And so we saw some restrictions on when the defense can be asserted. We saw some restrictions on... we actually have four states in the United States that don't allow for an insanity defense. Mm-hmm. Most people think that you have some constitutional right to raise an insanity defense. You do not. Mm-hmm. And if the state doesn't want to afford that, then you just don't get to raise it. So when Hinckley was acquitted, we saw some pushback and across the board. And many of the states adopted the straight McNaughton rule and did away with the irresistible impulse defense. And they also shifted the burden to the defendant to not just raise the defense, but to prove insanity. And that's pretty much the way we have it here in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. We're joined this evening by attorney Elton Ritchie and forensic psychiatry fellows Dr. Vinay Kothpalli and Erica Parker. I want to invite our listeners to phone in with your question or comment on mental illness and the criminal justice system at 1-800-552-8502. Doctors, what are y'all's thoughts about what Elton just had to say?
Thank you, Mr. Ritchie, for that. Mr. Ritchie mentioned that how Louisiana defines how one would invoke the insanity defense, specifically the part about being incapable of distinguishing right from wrong. So this we consider a cognitive capacity, being capable of distinguishing what is right, what is wrong. And I think, you know, several other, and many states use this variant, this McNaughton criteria, if you will, as their basis for their insanity defense laws or statutes. And some states also add a volitional component. This involves whether one was, you know, the cognitive component aside about being able to distinguish between right and wrong, is or was one able to adjust their behavior to meet, you know, the norms of the law, that kind of thing. And so most states follow either, you know, the McNaughton criteria or a variant of this McNaughton criteria, like the state of Louisiana does, or they also, in addition to the McNaughton-based criteria, they add that volitional component.
So when might an insanity defense be raised?
Well, first you have to have someone charged with a crime. Typically, it's going to be a serious crime. You know, one of the things, there are a number of interesting paradoxes about the insanity defense. One of them is that even if you're found not guilty by reason of insanity, you're going to likely be confined, possibly even longer than if you had been found guilty. For example, you might have a person who commits a misdemeanor offense, petty theft, shoplifting, car theft, something like that, where it's a relatively minor offense. And they might be eligible to raise an insanity defense for one, you know, reason or another, depending upon their history, their background, and everything. But it might not be worth doing so because the penalty that they would receive in terms of probation or incarceration for that minor offense is probably going to be less drastic than if they're found to have been not guilty by reason of insanity and then committed civilly and for probably an indeterminate period of time to be evaluated and to before it's determined, before you get a group of doctors who are willing to say that this person's not dangerous and can be released into society. So, you know, if it's probably going to be a serious crime, you're typically looking at a homicide. I'm trying to think if I've ever raised it in a non-homicide context. I may have, but it would have been in a some sort of violent crime context. But typically, you're going to be looking at a homicide.
And what the court would be interested in knowing from, you know, a medical psychiatric perspective is whether due to mental illness that behavior or act was the person due to their mental illness or mental status at the time, you know, incapable of distinguishing right from wrong and thus not guilty by reason of insanity. They're asking for an opinion potentially to help them, you know, determine that. That's for the court to determine.
I think one other really important point about that is that raising the not guilty by reason of insanity plea doesn't, it's just having a mental illness doesn't automatically imply that you can raise that plea.
Correct.
Because you can have a mental illness, but you can also know right from wrong at the time. Right. So just by default, having a mental illness does not necessarily mean that you should or that you qualify to raise a not guilty by reason of insanity plea.
Sure.
And that probably contributes to the misconception that you, Dr. Visconti, mentioned earlier about the perception that the insanity defense is very commonly used, when in fact, as Dr. Parker clarified, it's not just having mental illness that would necessarily qualify you to invoke the insanity defense. Mm-hmm. It's a rather stringent criteria in that, you know, due to mental illness or deformity of the mind.
Mental disease or defect.
Mental disease or defect, were you incapable of distinguishing right from wrong? So that's a rather strict criteria to meet.
It's even narrower than that. It's with respect to that specific conduct.
Right.
And this often confuses not just lay jurors, but it confuses judges and lawyers as well. and psychiatrists and psychologists. A person can understand the difference between right or wrong generally, or with respect to most of the things that are going on around them. But the question that is very narrow that's being asked in the insanity defense is with regard to the specific conduct in question. When that person committed that, what otherwise is a criminal act, did they understand the difference between right and wrong with regard to that act? Now, that's a sticky wicket. In the first place, how do we figure out what's right and what's wrong? By what objective standard do we measure that? Do we do it with respect to just the criminal law, or do we look to something bigger beyond that? And you can have, you know, people who are right as rain, as they say, who have sometimes have difficulty judging right or wrong. It's not necessarily a question of does it violate the law. A person can be insane and realize that they may be violating the law, but that doesn't mean that they understand that it's wrong. And that's the tough question that's being asked. And so the real difficulty with presenting the defense a lot of times is just getting the trier of fact to understand what the question is that they're being asked to address.
And the trier of fact is the judge?
No. It's going to be a juror.
Okay.
The way the process works in Louisiana is when you assert raise the defense of not guilty by re-insanity, the court appoints what is called in the law a lunacy commission. And that consists of two psychologists, psychiatrists, who evaluate the defendant and render an opinion as to both his competency to stand trial and whether they think at the time of the offense the person was sane or not. It's just an opinion. That's all it is, okay? The defendant has the burden at trial to prove by a preponderance of evidence that he was insane. The legal framework works like this. When a person is charged with a criminal offense, the law presumes that they are sane, that people are generally sane. Otherwise, you'd have to have you'd have to prove sanity every time you had a criminal trial. It's not practical, nor is it necessary, really. So when the defendant raises that defense, he raises it by a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity, and then we go through this process with the Lunacy Commission where they can subpoena evidence. Bet you didn't know you could do that, Doctor. You can subpoena records. You can subpoena all kinds of – you can call witnesses. You can take testimony. You could actually act as your own little court. Most never do that. They simply go visit the client in the jail. What I say sometimes is – I'm very critical of these, obviously. Sometimes a drive-by evaluation is done, and there's not a good evaluation of the client. But if done right – then the defense lawyer will have done his own investigation ahead of time, gathered the material that's necessary to present to the doctors. It requires a lot of historical documentation and evaluation. Probably retained his own psychiatrist or psychologist to do an independent evaluation, and then present all of that to the commission. They then render an opinion. That goes to the court, and it's available to the prosecution and to the defense and to the judge. And once a person enters that plea, then they have to submit to this, and they don't get to hide behind the doctor-patient privilege. They've got to open themselves up for examination. Now, what happens at that point, if the commission comes back with an opinion and they all agree and say, well, we think that he's right as rain, that doesn't prevent the defendant from still asserting that defense. He still has that burden at trial, okay? However, if the commission comes back and says, well, no, we think that that boy ain't right, as we say here in North Louisiana, and he wasn't sane, then the prosecutor's going to pause, and they're going to say, maybe we should not try this case. Maybe we should simply accept a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity and get this person on to a treatment facility.
And Elton, I'm going to pause you for a
minute. Certainly.
We have a caller and I want to get to them. They have been waiting patiently. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question really is for the forensic experts there. From what I have read, it appears that the forensic experts, when their opinions are sought, they tend to render opinions that favors whoever hires them. That is, their opinion appears to support the prosecution if they are hired by the prosecution, and it appears to support the defense if they are hired by the defense. Why do we have this range in opinion of experts?
Okay. So the caller is asking about opinions being rendered and whether being rendered by the person being hired by the prosecution or by the defense, and how that influences, at least that was my interpretation of the question. Mm-hmm. What are y'all's thoughts about that?
Well, you know, I can't speak for every forensic psychiatrist out there, but we are bound by certain ethical guidelines. I think that what may be causing this perception or is that oftentimes, let's say a defense attorney consults a forensic psychiatrist for an opinion regarding some matter of a criminal case, for instance, and there may be a discussion before a formal report is written that might influence the attorney to use or not use that expert testimony. So, you know, likewise, this could happen for the prosecution as well. If they were to retain a forensic expert to offer an opinion, and then before a formal report is written, they decide that it's not going to help their case, it is their, you know, under their, it's their purview to use that or to present that expert witness or not. So I think what you might see is that if it's not going to be favorable for a defense or for a prosecution, they may not use that expert testimony in that sense.
Yeah, and give that misperception that that whoever hires the mental health professional kind of influences their opinion.
Right, and when what I'd like to clarify, you know, or what I'd like to emphasize, though, is that we you know, as physicians being bound by certain ethical guidelines, you know, like I said, I can't speak for everyone that's out there, but I don't think most of us are simply offering what is being asked for.
Sure.
You know, a hired gun sort of approach that, you know, would be ethically dubious and not the way that we would conduct, you know, forensic evaluations and expert testimony.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller who had a question about crimes of passion. How does all this apply to crimes of passion, or does it apply?
Crimes of passion, I'm not sure what they mean by that, but typically, well, manslaughter is referred to as a crime of as a murder committed in the heat of passion, which is, that's kind of what you would call an imperfect kind of a self. Insanity defense, I guess. Someone commits a crime in heat of blood. They become so angry. You walk in and discover your lover with a stranger, something like that. Maybe. I suppose it's possible. It depends more on, you know, there's a lot more to it than just that instant. There's a lot of background history. A person who just walks in and discovers a situation and then becomes enraged and commits a crime like a homicide, the classic find your lover in bed with somebody else. That's not typically where you're going to see an insanity defense, but it's the idea of manslaughter, which is a lesser species of murder, is kind of the idea is that, well, that, you know, the conduct is mitigated somewhat because the person did become justifiably enraged, although the action they took as a result of that is not justified. So it's still a crime. You're not let off the hook, but we're just not going to punish you as bad.
And I think it would still boil down to the same criteria of being able to distinguish the difference between right from wrong, where somebody who's so enraged that they would hurt somebody else or kill somebody else, for finding them with their partner, it still comes down to, due to a mental illness or symptoms of mental illness, were they able to distinguish right from wrong at the time that this happened? So I don't know that there is really a distinction between that crime versus a different kind of crime.
So those criteria apply regardless.
Yes.
Right.
Sure.
And I might add that, you know, in the evolution of the insanity defense criteria, that kind of thing over time, at one point, you know, the irresistible impulse, so crimes of passion involve, you know, the sense of an irresistible impulse that rendered someone unable to control their action or something like that. And again, this would be something that would be, one, is not part of, for instance, Louisiana's insanity statute. But if, for argument's sake, we take that, this irresistible impulse, the issue becomes, can you prove that it was an impulse not resisted versus an irresistible impulse? And that's not an easy, you know, that's, again, stringent criteria.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller. We have Eva from Texas. Go right ahead with your question or comment.
Yes, ma'am. It's kind of a comment and also kind of a question. Over the years, as a professional in the medical realm, I've noticed that when we stopped, going back to the comment he made earlier about when we institutionalized people that we knew were mentally ill, a family member could go to the courts and say, I've seen this pattern with my family member, and he needs help or she needs help, and we need you to help us commit them or give us the power to have them institutionalized or hospitalized for a while to find out what's going on. When all of that kind of disappeared over the last few generations, be it humanity or laws or whatever it may be, when that went away, we've seen a higher number of people going to prison who have the mental illnesses like y'all were talking about earlier. And when we see that, we also see a continuous flow of higher recidivism rate in our prisons. And most all of them have some sort of mental illness diagnosed in their lifetime. But yet we've taken more power away from the families who are the people who know these people the best. We've taken the power away from the families to be able to tell someone, hey, this person needs to be institutionalized or needs to be hospitalized against their will, and the law is not willing to stand up for that. What's been your experience in your career with these issues?
Yes, comments?
Well, I'll, from my legal perspective, my career has been in criminal law, so I don't often see it come up prior to it becoming a problem that causes someone to bump up against the criminal justice system. But we know that to be the case, and I think, as was pointed out earlier, with the increase in substance abuse and over the past decades, it's gotten even worse. But because of the criminalization of substance abuse, we see more of those people coming into the criminal justice system. Now, maybe y'all may handle more civil-related litigation in terms of commitments for civil commitments and that sort of thing. Then I just don't get involved in that, so I can't really speak to it.
I feel that even just in an emergency room setting, I feel like oftentimes family members will bring in a patient on an order of protective custody saying that the person hasn't been taking their medicine or has had really unusual behavior and that they're concerned. And then I think that today that the emergency room kind of serves as the median where patients come from, you know, from their homes or from their families that are brought in into the mental health system. And again, I think it all kind of does, again, go back to community supports of, or lack thereof, where we do end up seeing a lot of them in the emergency rooms and then, or police pick them up and they end up in jail. So I think today the way we address that is by having things like orders of protective custody where you call the police or you bring your family member to the emergency room to get help or for treatment.
Mm-hmm. And I would echo Dr. Parker's sentiments. I think that, you know, when it comes to the deinstitutionalization that occurred, the movement away from institutionalizing the mentally ill, I think that, you know, that is, you know, was a good thing, you know, that it was well conceived in the sense that we want people in the least restrictive setting possible to help them function. You know, so if people didn't need to be institutionalized, then they shouldn't. But this is all based on the idea that there are the community supports in place that Dr. Parker is.
I think the sentiments were good. The intention was good, but the planning was poor.
Right.
Execution very poor.
Yeah.
All we've really done is move them from one institution to another.
Yeah.
From what was, I think, probably a better institutional setting into one that's worse.
Yeah.
And I think probably does more damages to collateral damage to their loved ones and their family.
Sure.
Because once you've been convicted of a criminal offense, even a minor, relatively minor felony, even if you're released back out into the community, you suffer all sorts of collateral consequences that impact your ability to be a productive citizen. And when you take someone who already suffers from intellectual disabilities or mental disabilities and handicaps that really affect their ability to be an effective member in society, and then you handicap them with additional legal hurdles and legal obstacles that block them at every turn, you do a tremendous amount of damage, not just to them, but also to their families and those around them.
I want to invite our listeners to call in with your questions or comments. We're talking about mental illness in the criminal justice system this evening. The number is 1-800-552-8502. Are there any other misconceptions about insanity that you feel like we need to discuss? I know that we talked a little bit about the fact that that there is a misconception that it's used pretty frequently. Anything else that you feel like the public should know about the insanity defense?
Maybe the conception that if you are successful in raising the insanity defense and are found not guilty by reason of insanity, that it means you get out of whatever
it
is.
You don't get off scot-free.
No, you don't.
No.
In general, it involves lengthy, commitment for mental health treatment, that kind of thing, with continuing a follow-up to determine, for instance, for criminal dangerousness, that kind of thing.
Yeah, almost indefinitely. And in the case of someone who would otherwise have been sentenced to a life imprisonment or to death, then they're simply going to be there committed for life. Just that simple. There's another interesting paradox that applies to insanity cases in the insanity defense, and it's this: the more serious the mental health illness and the more evidence you have of serious mental defect or disease, then the more likely you're going to be considered dangerous, and maybe the more dangerous that you are. And paradoxically, those are the people who tend not to be found not guilty by reasonable insanity. Jurors tend to reject it most in those kinds of cases, simply because they're just fearful of those people. I mean, people are fearful of people who have serious mental health problems. Even people who have minor mental health problems, people are fearful of them. And when you have someone who has clearly committed a crime, and they are raising that defense, and they have serious evidence of their mental health, it just makes them appear even that much more dangerous, and so jurors are less likely to find them not guilty by reason of saying, largely because of this misconception that you mentioned, that people think that, oh, well, they're just going to get off scot-free, or they're not going to be punished in some respect.
No, and there's a large facility in Louisiana. I visited it. It has, fences and, and barbed wire and so forth, where these people go, to receive treatment and to stay for sometimes for the rest of their lives. So we have another caller. We have Alice from Alexandria. Go right ahead with your question or comment.
Never mind. Bye.
Okay.
Thank you.
So Another prong of kind of where the criminal justice system and psychology and psychiatry intersect is competence. Would y'all mind talking a little bit about competence, what that is, and how we determine competence?
Sure. When we talk about competence, we're really talking about a competence to stand trial. And there are a lot of criteria that go along with this as well. There's something called the Dusky criteria, which would be the first part of it, which any patient or client needs to have the ability to be able to talk with their lawyer, to consult with their lawyer, and have a rational understanding of what they're being charged with, an understanding of what's going on, and to be able to understand what the proceedings are and to have like a factual and rational understanding of the proceedings that are against him. And then there's a second part of criteria, which are called the Bennett criteria, which there's quite a few of them, but things like the patient has to be able to be aware of the nature of the proceedings. They have to be able to understand the proceedings in a courtroom. They need to be able to identify who are the main players in a courtroom. So when we do examinations regarding competency to stand trial, we really want to make sure that they understand who is the judge. What is a lawyer? What is a lawyer's job? What is a jury? What do they do? And to be able to understand what the possible verdicts of their convictions could possibly be, what are the outcomes, and to know that they understand what things like a plea bargain are and they could participate in one and make decisions regarding them, as well as being able to relate with their lawyer, be able to assist in their own defense by calling witnesses and being able to relay the events that led up to whatever they are charged with and to be able to give like a rational, plausible explanation for these things. So there are quite a few criteria that go into deciding competence about whether or not somebody can go ahead and stand trial.
Mm-hmm. And we as citizens have a specific interest in this because, you know, the court system doesn't want to try people who aren't competent to stand trial. It would create an ethical issue. And we'd want these kind of, you know, for the purpose of the carriage of justice, we would want to make sure that somebody is competent to stand trial and able to, as Dr. Parker mentioned, participate in their defense and understand the proceedings that they're facing.
Competency is really different than sanity because it has to do with the present mental status of the person.
That's right.
And I have had clients who were not competent, and it's you're correct that we don't want to be pushing people through the criminal justice system who aren't competent to understand what's going on around them. First off, there's this whole idea of the criminal justice system is to hold people accountable for their moral failings that have caused harm to other people, and to be able to appreciate that, you know, that they have done something that transgressed the law and that has harmed someone and that they need to be made to held accountable for that. So a person who's not competent really can't do that. They don't get it. They don't get why they're why this is going on, why they're being prosecuted, and they can't though they may know who the judge is and the prosecutor and what his job is and all that stuff. The biggest problem that I've encountered, and I'm sure y'all have had more competency cases than I have because y'all review these pretty regularly. It only comes up for me occasionally in my practice. But is the idea where you come across a client who just cannot rationally assess the evidence, just can't do it. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult because are they saying that because they don't want to accept the rational conclusions, or they're not capable of making and following those rational conclusions? And that's the more difficult case of competency. Most people are going to be found competent, and I have my experiences, even when there was overwhelming evidence that the person was not competent, the court tends to go ahead and find them that way, simply because we want to keep the train moving. And so you can't move the case forward if the person's not competent. It just has to stop until they can be made competent, if at all possible. So the the tendency, the inertia, is to find competency, move the case forward, even when in the face of some pretty strong evidence that a person's not competent. But
and when somebody is found or deemed to be not competent to stand trial, there is a procedure that ensues where restoration of competence is attempted. Now, this could be if they're not competent to stand trial because of mental illness, that kind of thing. They're not able to have a factual, rational understanding of the proceedings before them and inability to assist their defense counsel, then they would attempt to restore that, you know, whether that means forensic education or if it means, you know, health treatment, you know, mental health treatment.
Medication.
Or to both. Get them back there.
Yeah.
Doctors, would you speak a little bit about your process as far as determining sanity and determining competence? How do you do that?
Yeah, I want to know that.
Yeah.
How do you read those tea leaves?
You know, we have, you know, there are guidelines, there are things that guide us in this process, but, you know, how do I explain this, you know, rather quickly? We look at a number of things. As Mr. Ritchie, you know, mentioned, we get the state's discovery response, we get records from attorneys, we get medical records, we get from, you know, a number of places. We review all of this. We also have lengthy evaluations with the defendant, you know, sometimes multiple evaluations on more than one occasion if there are unanswered questions, that kind of thing. But basically, in a nutshell, we review all this material. We conduct a thorough clinical evaluation. We look at their history of, you know, their medical history, their psychiatric history. We look at what the, you know, the state's facts say or what the state's discovery says about what is alleged to have happened. We listen to what the defendant states, you know, what their...
Right, what their position...
Right.
And one of the things, I was joking about the tea leaves, one of the things that we have recently done, you actually watched interaction with a client and myself,
mm-hmm.
and saw where that relationship turned really
sure.
obviously to where mm-hmm. he had moved from being competent to where he just completely decompensated in your presence. So watching the interaction with the lawyer can be a very, very important tool.
And when we're doing this evaluation, when we're doing a competency evaluation, that's different than when we're doing an insanity evaluation. When we're doing a competency evaluation, we're trying to determine, are they able to meet these Bennett criteria that are required by Louisiana statute? Can they, do they have a factual and rational understanding of the proceedings before them? Can they assist their, you know, defense counsel? And if they are not able to do these things, we render an opinion suggesting that, you know, in our medical opinion, you know, which is that they're, you know, whether or not they're able to do that. And then the court takes that opinion and makes a decision. Specifically, your question was about the insanity defense. When we do an evaluation for that, you know, after a very thorough clinical evaluation, reviewing all the material, we are again looking at the bottom line, was the defendant, due to mental illness at the time of the alleged event, incapable of distinguishing right from wrong. So we are trying to offer an opinion with medical certainty, with reasonable medical certainty, about whether or not, you know, they were incapable of distinguishing right from wrong.
Right. And assessing insanity at the time of the crime is different from competency in the context that at the time of the crime, we would, besides just interviewing the defendant, we would interview maybe family members, or we would interview other people that were there at the time or who had spent time with the defendant in around that day or in those days, and even get things like school records or past medical records and things around that specific time period.
And when I do these evaluations, I find that more difficult, trying to kind of recreate what was going on in the defendant's mind at the time of the crime can be very, very difficult to determine what exactly was going on at that time.
Yeah. And like Dr. Parker was saying, it's a different kind of evaluation, because with competency, you're dealing with the present. How is that person right now? What's their mental state? That sort of thing. So it's a different thing. And the other thing procedurally that's different is that that doesn't go to the jury. That's a question for the court, and the court's going to rely on that competency commission and those opinions to determine whether the client's competent to proceed or not. And so that's a pretrial kind of an issue. It's not something that takes place at trial, although you can have situations where clients decompensate at trial, maybe they stop taking medication or something like that. But even then, that's really a question for the judge. That's not a question for a jury.
So we have just a few more minutes left. Any parting thoughts or bits of wisdom that you would like to share with our listening audience? Elton, I know you're full of wisdom.
Full of something. I would say this. I would speak to really to any lawyers that might be listening out there. If you're got a client that you think might not be competent or might have been insane at the time, you really, really need to hire your own expert, like Dr. Parker, like yourself, or one of the colleagues here, to do that evaluation and tell you everything that they need to be looking at. Because the truth is that when you hire an expert witness, particularly a psychologist, a psychiatrist, their opinion is only going to be as good as the information that's put in front of them. And so a lot of times our job as the lawyer is to do the research, do the investigation, and bring all that information to the table. But we also need to know from them what information to look for, because we don't know that. Lawyers are not really trained in that regard. So that would be my parting thought. That if you've got a client who might fall into this category, to take the time and invest in some time with an expert.
Doctors?
I would add that, you know, as someone who provides mental health care, what I deal with a lot of the time is the stigma that's associated with the idea of mental illness, behavioral illness, and the barriers that presents for people to seek treatment. And then when we combine, or when we consider also that people not receiving, you know, not having the proper supports in place to remain compliant with treatment or to seek treatment, find themselves into the criminal justice system and then into incarceration, those types of things, that, you know, we're really doing an injustice to our, you know, the community at large if we're not able to provide those kind of supports. Because, you know, my theory is that as a mental health provider, if people were ideally keeping up with their treatment, that they would never get involved with the criminal justice system sometimes, oftentimes.
Well, thank you to our guests this evening. We had Elton Ritchie, attorney and forensic psychiatry fellows, Dr. Vinay Bhathapally, and Erica Parker. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. The views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not necessarily reflect those of Red River Radio or of LSUS or staff. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, and the production assistance provided this evening by Tim Snell, Wally Derleth, and Al Villarreal. Support for this program comes from the Knoll Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Tune in each Thursday for Health Matters. I'm Dr. Shelley Visconti. Thank you for joining us this evening, and have a great evening.